Broadcasting from deep within the second realm, you are listening to agoristradio.com.
Hello, this is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. Agoristradio.com is sponsored by MetroPie.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible.
Hello, welcome back to Cypherpunked. This is Hero White, and we have another special guest today, Bill St. Clair of the True Ledger Project. And as a little intro, I'll read from the website. True Ledger is an anonymous, digitally signed general ledger and trading system. Like Loom, it allows anyone to issue assets. Unlike Loom, which relies entirely on very good obscurity for security, True Ledger's digital signatures allow the server and the client to prove to each other that they agreed at a particular time on their balances. It does this while allowing destruction of transaction history for closed trades. So that's a right off the front intro, but we're going to dive into this and look at the GUI and talk about some of the differences here with Bill. Bill, can you hear me? You there?
Yes, I'm here. Hello, Hiro.
All right. Thanks for coming on the show. Hey, Bill. It's great to talk to you in person. Usually we've just exchanged stuff in chat rooms. That's been the case with many of our guests here. So I gave this little introduction to True Ledger. Do you want to tell us a little bit more intro information on it?
Well, True Ledger grew out of discussions I had with Patrick Chikorov, who's the inventor and the maintainer of Loom. And I got to know Loom pretty well, and we exchanged some ideas, and he used some of the ideas I had. And I like Loom. It's very simple, about as simple as you can get, and very secure. And the only thing I noticed about it was you basically have to trust that the server is keeping your assets secure. I realized that if your money ever disappeared in Loom, there's nothing you could do about it. I have no evidence that money ever disappears in Loom. Patrick seems to keep that server running really well. And because of the way Loom works, amounts are stored in certain assets, but he can't tell who has them. Uh-huh. And the reason that it's open for him seeing what the amounts are was there are some of the users of Loom that require that he be audit their balances to make sure that the Loom system is in balance. True Ledger also allows anyone with access to the file system where it stores things to see what it is, but only identified by public key. That's the only identification anybody has on True Ledger. But anyway, I decided I wanted to have a way so that you and the True Ledger server could prove to each other that you had agreed on balances. Rather than just trusting the server to keep your balances okay, you would have a copy yourself, and you could say later on, well, look, here I have proof signed by you, the server, that this was my balance. And unless you have a later dated proof that it's something different, well, you're going to have to take my word for it.
Right.
Because I have proof here. It's signed by you, and it's digitally signed, and So far, I see no reason that there's any way of forging digital signatures unless you happen to give your private key away.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. I built a whole system based on digital signatures. It uses digital signatures as authorization. There's no login and password. You have a passphrase that you use to unlock your private key, but your public key is the only way that the TrueLedger server recognizes you. You use your private key to sign a message and send it over there, and it uses your public key to verify your signature. And if it verifies, it knows that it's from you or it's from someone who stole your private key.
Right.
But no one without your private key could send such a message.
Right.
In normal use, you expect that you run a TrueLedger client on your own PC and you have your private key there, and your unencrypted private key never is anywhere else except on your computer. And so that's about as safe as I could figure out how to make it. And actually, it's never stored anywhere except in RAM on your computer inside of the TrueLedger client. That never hits disk. Well, it probably hits swap space sometimes.
Right.
So if you want to be really secure, you got to have an encrypted swap space. But
Great.
Now, I do have a feature where you can store your private key, your encrypted private key, on the TrueLedger server, and that's mostly a way to protect yourself so you have a backup in case you happen to lose your PC, because if you lose your private key, you're lost.
Mm-hmm.
Now, people who run TrueLedger servers, and currently there aren't any of them, could certainly have a way of identifying their customers another way, so that if a customer lost his private key, they'd have some way of recovering their assets by transferring them to a new account. And the server would be able to do that.
Uh-huh.
So I haven't done most of that administration type of stuff yet, because I haven't had any users or any requests for what it is and haven't started trying to imagine what it is.
Right. Okay.
Now, the other thing that I should say is the whole idea with this was, if you and the server ever disagreed on what your balance was, there should be a process, an automated process whereby you get back an agreement, and whoever's has the newer signed balance is the one that is agreed with, and the other one has to figure out how to deal with being out of balance because of that. Well, I haven't written that code yet, so the only code that I've actually written that's actually running is, oh, we're out of agreement, server, I'm going to trust you and use whatever you decide my balance is, which of course, so I haven't actually gotten to the end result of what I wanted to do at the very beginning, and I have thought about that a lot and pretty much know what to do, but the problem is that the server will then be out of balance because it's giving you some extra money it didn't know it had to, and so you have to figure out what to do about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure yet.
Well, one of the things, while we're on this, the topic of the agreed balance, fellow traveler admired this feature in your system quite a bit because it allowed for you to destroy past transaction history, yet still have a way to have an agreement as to what the balance was between both.
Yeah, in standard ledgers, the way that you believe your balance is, you look at the past transaction history, and you both say, okay, I wrote all these checks and I made all these deposits, and so this must be my balance. And though in the client you have the ability to save a history, just as in Loom you have the ability to save a client history if you want to, you don't have to, and that history isn't used for anything.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that's used is the signed balances. And because they're all digitally signed, you know that they weren't forged on either side.
Mm-hmm.
So,
briefly on this while we're here, what mechanism are you doing for verification of proving that a particular person has the last signed proof?
Well, there's a timestamp that goes on every single record, and that is always incrementing, and is usually it's usually the Unix time, Greenwich Mean Time, in seconds, since whenever Unix time is kept since, and sometimes you can put a decimal on the end of it if you get two transactions that are closer together than a second, just so that they're always, the timestamps are always unique. And so that's an ever-increasing number. Those numbers are handed out by the server only, so you know that those numbers, you're not going to get two of the same because they were handed out by different people with different ideas of what time it is.
Uh-huh.
And so whoever has the timestamp that's bigger, well, he's the winner.
Yeah.
Okay, but are both people, I mean, when you said that, what I would thought would happen is that there would be a timestamp, a balance, and both people would sign.
Yes,
both people would
that's
sign
true.
That.
What happens is when you send a request to pay or to accept or to spend or to accept a spend, you sign the balance from the client, and when the server agrees with it, it countersigns that. So you end up with a balance record that has a timestamp and an asset ID and the bank ID and a balance, and then is signed by the client, the customer, and then that whole message is signed by the bank, by the server. So everything is signed and countersigned.
Okay, and then the client gets back a copy of this of everything signed from the.
Yes, and so he keeps both places keep in their databases of balances for particular asset types the doubly signed records, mm-hmm. so they both know that they both agreed to that
okay.
at that particular time.
Okay.
And there's a detailed document about exactly what the format of all those messages is that's linked from the homepage of TrueLedger.com.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Let's give out that URL. Some people may want to go to that right now. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. TrueLedger.com.
Right. Okay. Originally, some people are familiar with this. It was called True Bank, and then you changed the name to True Ledger. So, just linking that up.
Yeah, that was at request of someone who may possibly be my first actual live implementation of this. That he didn't want the word bank in it anywhere because he thought he might have a less of a chance of the bankers deciding that. It was something they didn't like.
Yeah,
I think just like with eGold and anything else, if it becomes popular enough and has enough money in it, the bankers aren't going to like it no matter what you call it. So,
right. there's the language is very important right now. It's kind of silly that it has to be that way, but I mean, one example is some guy who buys gold, digital gold. You know, he's just a merchant who buys gold. And you can have another guy who sells it, and he's just a merchant who sells gold. But if you have someone who buys and sells it, then all of a sudden he's a money service business, you know. So, I mean, you know, they're really trying to play word games with anyone inside of this new realm of money transfer and storage and the like. Well, let's go ahead.
Well, they have an incredible counterfeiting gig going, and when anybody tries to step on their toes by offering real money, they get very nervous.
Yeah, yeah. I saw an article yesterday from linked to on John Matana's Twitter. It was this. It was called a fetid tale of fiat money, something. And there was another article out there talking about casino chips, and they were saying that Bitcoin is the ultimate casino chip right now in terms of the story of what happened in some of these gambling towns in the past where there's two areas to this. One is the people were using these coins, these casino chips, as currency inside of their city. It became a replacement for Federal Reserve notes and other forms of money. And they cracked down on that. I guess it's very highly illegal to be doing that. And then there was another article brought up the issue of the casino chips where people found them to be more handy for usage, just like in the first story. But the casino themselves realized that since people are using it for money and they had the ability to print them up, that they just manufactured and flooded the market with these casino chips that they were running, and the story was relating to that's how the bankers were doing it. So Yeah.
Yes, and they caused inflation in that market just like the bankers do in the real world fiat markets.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's go ahead and go through this because before we get into some questions about the security and let's go over the infrastructure of this. People can go to the TrueLedger.com website, and you can go to the section at the bottom of the client binaries and actually download your software. Now, as background information, go ahead.
No, you finish.
Yeah, I was going to say background information. I believe this was written in Lisp. Is that correct?
Yes, I did an initial version in PHP and then realized that in the PHP version, I had to have the server's private key in plain text on the disk because I had no real way of storing it inside of the PHP binary. And so that was sort of a killer problem. And in the Lisp version, the server's private key is stored encrypted, and when you start the server, somebody has to type in the passphrase for that key, and then it decrypts it and stores it in RAM. And it never is anywhere else except in RAM inside of the server.
Okay. Great. Now, this is a client. You have two binaries here. You have the server, which is run by the server operator. And the users download a client, and this is a multi-platform. Does this run on all three of the main platforms?
Yeah, if you click on client binaries, you'll see that there's a version for Windows 32 and 64-bit, Linux 32 and 64-bit, macOS 64-bit, and FreeBSD 64-bit. And the 32-bit versions of macOS and FreeBSD, I just haven't had a machine available to build. And it's about an 8.5 meg download. It expands into about 25 megs. It's a single file. I really need to build an installer for Windows because there are some things that might be that are a little bit confusing for Windows users without having that and having a standard place for it to be.
Okay.
It's basically that you have to start it from the same directory every time because that's how it tells where to look for its database files.
Okay. I downloaded
it. But it will work. And one reason that I did it this way, that I picked Lisp to do it in, is because I was able to save a single executable file for all of these different operating systems out of the same source code.
Great. I downloaded the Linux version, and it was a tar.gz file, and I extracted that and just, ./ and the binary file name, and it ran. It was no dependencies, anything. And what?
Okay, and it brought up your browser window aimed at itself. Did it do that?
Hold on a second here. Oh yeah, you know what? It did, and I didn't even realize that window came up. I went. And,
yeah, so you've got a client there. You can work on your own client. You don't even have to work. There is a client running on the TrueLedger site. It doesn't have any SSL on it, so anything you type to it is seeable by the world.
Right.
Of course, the application that you downloaded is actually client and server. It's all bundled into one. And when you start it up as you have, only the client is running. You have to go through a server setup procedure in order to get the server running, in order to create the server private key and create an admin account and initialize everything. There are directions on the TrueLedger site for doing that if you want to run your own.
Okay. We'll get into that in a sec. When I ran this, I what I saw was client web server started at port 8782, and I just went and opened up my browser and went there. And then I just looked back, and there's another tab that was already open. So it did open up in a new tab. So this runs. This doesn't have a graphical user interface that's native to the operating system. This actually runs a web server.
Yes, it is a web server, and that's the only interface to it. And so the graphical part is done by your web browser.
Great.
And so you never do anything to that except type Control-C at it to make it stop. Or close the window that it's in, and that'll also make it stop.
Okay.
Now,
go ahead.
you have to start it from the same directory every time because it creates a subdirectory of wherever you start it from that has your database in it, and that stores your private keys and your balances and all of that stuff.
Okay. Well, I'm going to run this client web interface, the local here, and just we'll go through this because there's some questions in like that we can cover in here. So the first thing I see is...
Anyway, first I want to tell people that there is a client documentation link down right with... There's TrueLedger client, client documentation, and client binaries. And if you go in the client documentation, you can see screenshots of what we're going to be going through now.
Oh, great. Okay. Super.
And you can also go to the TrueLedger client, although without having a coupon for me in order to get a new account, you won't be able to go very far.
Okay.
That's what we're going to go through. So I've already pasted in our chat a TrueLedger coupon. It looks like a left square bracket, the TrueLedger.com URL, a comma, and then a hex number, and then a right square bracket. That hex number, the URL is there, so it knows which server to contact, and the hex number is the location, is the identity of a coupon that I minted with some TrueLedger usage tokens. TrueLedger uses usage tokens the same as Loom does. You have to buy locations in order to use storage space on the server.
Okay. Can you post one of these links, one of these coupons inside the IRC channel?
Oh, okay.
I mean, if it's convenient. If not, we can do it later.
Yeah, no problem. There, that's it. That's a live coupon, so until you use that, that's worth 200 usage tokens to whoever has it on this server. And in Loom, usage tokens are worth about a penny a piece. That's what Patrick sells them for.
Right. Okay, so you're calling the usage tokens coupons. The invite.
The invite is called a coupon.
Right.
You can actually mint a coupon in any asset type. So I could give you a coupon for 10 grams of gold, and you'd be able to deposit that in your account, and you'd have 10 grams of gold, or 10 grams of my gold. Whereas TrueLedger, of course, it's just a binary thing, so it can't store real assets, but it stores promissory notes that usually stand for real assets stored in a safe somewhere. I expect that's how it will usually be used. But as in Loom, they could stand for Boy Scout hours or any other thing that you want to have a contract to deliver on demand.
Right. And this coupon is, I guess it's of what you would call in the open transaction systems a voucher, the same as the voucher safe also, correct?
Well, it's similar to that. It's not quite the same thing because whoever spends it first gets it. And maybe VoucherSafe works that way too. But it's basically like a dollar bill, except you can make as many copies of it as you want, and whoever turns it into the server first is the one that's going to get it.
Yeah.
Anybody else, if they turn it in later, it'll say, sorry, that coupon's already been spent, or I don't know anything about that coupon.
Oh, that's great. Okay. Super. Now, let's go through the registration here. So the first thing I see is a passphrase screen, assuming
right.
that I have an account.
Let me get that up on my machine. And so you should click on the register a new account link. And that'll bring you to a bigger passphrase screen. And then you enter a passphrase twice, once is the passphrase, once is the verification. And this, I advise you write it down because I won't be able to recover it if you forget it.
Yep.
And case is important. Everything is important. Any character you type, you have to type again when you do it again. And then you can paste the coupon from the left square bracket to the right square bracket into the coupon area there. You can stick a name on your account if you want to. And that label will be, other people will be able to see that, or you can just remain completely anonymous and only identified by your public key. Mm-hmm. And only other people that you tell about your account will be able to know who you really are by whichever alias you use when you talk to those particular people.
Okay, so this coupon needs to be in the same format that you, exact same format that you pasted within the brackets, is that correct?
Right, yeah, paste from the left square bracket through the right square bracket, okay. That whole thing. And I think I have some smarts that if you miss one of the square brackets, it does the right thing. But I don't remember all the details about that.
Okay. All right, I am creating an account here. And what kind of communication is happening between the client and the server right now?
Okay, well, the other things we didn't talk about is there's a default to cache your encrypted private key on the server, which I recommend because then if you lose your private key, you have a possibility of getting back to your account.
Uh-huh.
And that's a little bit less secure than just storing it yourself because now someone's got those bits, and if they want to go try to brute force your passphrase, they could do that, and if they succeed, then they'll have access to your account.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the only person who has this is the server operator, and you basically have to trust the server operator. The server is able to counterfeit assets. Nothing I could do about that. I mean, the server can create a new account and have it sign some assets, and then the server can countersign those, and boom. The server can't change your balance, but you have to trust that whoever the asset issuers are, that they actually have as much of that asset in storage as TrueLedger thinks they do. And if somebody counterfeits assets on the server, then you're going to have inflation there just like you can in fiat money. So you're going to have to trust the issuer anyway because you only have his word that he says he's got 10 kilos of gold in the safe, and so it's okay for him to have 10,000 grams of his gold assets in the TrueLedger. So the issuer also has to trust the server operator that he's not going to counterfeit any of those things. And, of course, all depends on it's all based on trust in some way.
Yes.
And servers that prove to be untrustworthy and asset issuers that prove to be untrustworthy, well, their assets won't get used and their servers won't get used. So,
well, this is the same. This is a trust issue that is a different problem, and it's inherent in most. It's inherent
right.
in most systems. So,
there's no way around it. Once you're going to some computer somewhere and believing that those bits that you store there mean something in the real world, well, you're trusting someone to actually hold with their promise that that's true.
Yeah.
Anyway, the other things that you chose here is your key size. I'm recommending a key size of 3072. I support from 512 to 4096. And it looks like 3072 is supposed to be good for another 20 years at any rate, unless we get these fancy quantum computers that can go, many orders of magnitude faster than we currently have.
Yeah.
So did it create your account?
I'm in there now. I have the menu up here with balance, contacts, servers, assets, fees, permissions, admin, and logout.
Okay, and you should see something in the inbox there, which is the 200 usage tokens that I gave to you, along with a message that I put on that coupon.
Welcome to TrueLedger Hero.
Actually, let me look at mine here and see if I see you. I also see... did you already accept those tokens?
Oh, no, I did not. Let's see.
Okay.
Oh, I was just looking at the inbox here. Yeah, I see that I have...
Yeah, and so you have a way of accepting that. It's not part of your balance until you accept... when you make a spend in TrueLedger, it goes in your outbox and it goes in the recipient's inbox.
Right.
So you can see that the recipient hasn't done anything. Yeah, I still see this coupon sitting here in my outbox.
Right. I just processed my inbox and I see my balance.
Okay, and so... Now, I will see in my inbox an accept request from you for this, and I notice that you called yourself Bitcoins. And so I have the choice now of giving you a nickname. I think you had the choice of giving me a nickname before you did the accept.
Okay.
There's a little fill-in box there. So, of course, I'm going to call that HIRO when I process my inbox so that I know that Bitcoins is HIRO. Now if I go over to my contacts page, I'll see that I have HIRO as Bitcoins. And it has your ID there, which is a long, I think it's 160 bits. It's a SHA-1 hash.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, when I can give this ID to other people, or they see it when I send a transaction to them, and this is where they
Of course, yeah, you can't send a transaction to them unless you know who they are, and there are two ways to know who they are. One is to have a transaction from them before via a coupon or via them spending to you, and the other is that you can type in the recipient ID, that long hex number. You know, you see your ID there. That's what you'd tell people. That's how you're identified. That's actually the hash of your public key.
Right, okay.
And so you can give that to people, and they can enter that in the contacts page and give it a nickname. There's a way in the contacts page to add contacts.
Mm-hmm. Now, I see here on the balance page, right on the right-hand side, there's a spend form here where you put in the spend amount, and then the recipient, I see that I have a drop-down here with my contacts already in the drop-down.
And right.
Next
so
to that...
So actually, I'm going to spend to you 10 Bill Gold Grams with a note. The other interesting thing is there's always a note you can add with any spend, and so you can use zero spends as a way of doing messaging.
Inside of the note field?
Right, yeah. So you could just use this as a messaging system to send people notes with no money. Now, you actually have to spend 2 usage tokens in order to do a spend. And if the other guy rejects your spend, he takes your usage tokens. That's the spam avoidance procedure. If the other guy accepts your spend, you get the usage tokens back.
Okay, and so the entire spend amount, the recipient, the note, I mean, what information in here when it goes into the system is encrypted on the server?
None of it is actually encrypted on the server unless the server has an encrypted file system. Those records are stored in plain text in the file system, all signed. You'll notice that the only identification in that is your ID. And so if someone has a way outside of the system of identifying who you are by your ID in the system, then they'd have a way of looking at that information on the server and saying, here's spends that you have outstanding. The thing is, once that spend has been accepted or rejected, it's gone. There's no record of it anymore on the system. There's a record of your account and what your balances are, and anyone with access to the file system of the server can look at those and see what they are related to your ID and related to whatever name you gave away when you registered.
This payment information here for a spend, it's going to be signed by, if I send you some assets right now, it's going to be signed by my key, and then the recipient ID and everything is inside of that information that was signed, and then the server has it sitting there. And when you log in, it shows you the things that have that are pending for you. And then when you process your inbox, the server looks and confirms that these things were signed by me to give to you. It confirms that with the signature, with my signature, and then it takes care of the balance transfer between the accounts based on these signatures.
Right. Well, actually, the money leaves your account when you do the spend, and it sits in your outbox and in the inbox of the recipient.
Oh, okay.
You can cancel the spend before he accepts it, and you'll get it back. Although you lose your usage tokens when you cancel a spend, that's a way to discourage you from doing spends and canceling them over and over again.
Okay.
Once he accepts the spend, then it will disappear from his inbox, and you'll see that he accepted it in your outbox.
Okay.
And then you can acknowledge that, and it disappears from your outbox, and you get the tokens back.
Okay. Great. Yeah.
I just did a spend of some Bill Goldgrams to you, and so if you click your balance link, you should see that in your inbox. I see them in my outbox. If you accept that, then the Bill Goldgrams will come into your account.
Okay, let's go through this request in the inbox here, because there's some interesting things.
Oh, there's actually something useful. If you click on the Show Raw Balance, you'll see the actual text that is stored in the database for your inbox and for your account balances.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's nice.
So, and those are the actual strings that are stored in the database. I mean, I highlighted some stuff, and I took the signatures off because they mostly... There's a colon and a long signature that comes at the end of each of these parenthesized messages, and I've removed those for display because they aren't useful for most people to look at.
Yeah, no, it's great. I see the little hash array here, whatever, of inbox, spin, transfee. This is interesting. The little note in there. Any developers out there listening, check that out. It's that's cool. That's nice to have in there for.
Well, and there's also more. There's a down further on the a balance page is a button that says enable debugging. And if you do that, then every time you do a transaction at the bottom of the page, you get a debug log that shows what message was sent to the server and what message was returned.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Good.
That's mostly used by me when I'm trying to figure out why something doesn't work.
Yeah, but I mean, a lot of us can find that interesting when we're looking at, you know, what's going on here, you know, to kind of peek back
behind
the curtain.
And once you're logged in, all of the communication between client and server is encrypted. There's a session key created, and it expires after a period of time, and then it'll create a new session key, and all of the other information is encrypted going over the wire. So you don't even need to have an HTTPS connection between client and server, because TrueLedger does that by itself.
Okay.
Your client is... Pardon? Yeah.
In that connection, does it open up a connection and keep it a single connection open and then just send stuff back and forth, or is it sending out a request and getting back the information like an HTTP type?
Well, it is HTTP, but it uses Keep Alive just like your browser does in order to be able to get images that go with a page faster.
Okay.
It's all just those messages that you see in the raw balance page sent over HTTP.
Okay.
That's all documented in the internal documentation that you can get to from the TrueLedger main page.
Mm-hmm. Let's go through one of these spins that I just received in my inbox. There's several fields here. First one, request, that shows what kind of this is. It says spend. What other kind of request would be possibly listed there?
The spend can be of two kinds. One is a spend to another person, and one is a spend to yourself, which transfers balances, basically. I don't think those ever hit your inbox. No,
okay.
Those are just all done in one big thing. You have the ability of having multiple different accounts inside of your wallet so that you can keep your money separated into, you know, like checking and savings and... this money I promised to somebody, whatever.
okay.
And then the transfee is, that's where the usage tokens happen for the transfer. And if you look at the end of that, you see comma 2, just before the right parenthesis. It cost you 2 usage tokens. There can be transaction fees that are paid to the server. And the server operator decides if they want to have those, and those do not get refunded. And there can also be storage fees from the asset issuer, which you pay every time you make a spend. You pay for the storage of that asset, because you're basically, what's happening here is whoever issued the assets has a bunch of gold sitting in a safe, and he's got to keep that safe secure. And it costs him money to have that safe, and it costs him money to have the security for that safe. And he's not making any money off of you doing trades with his asset unless he collects it somehow. And the storage fee is the way that we're doing that.
Yeah, right.
Or, you know, banks loan out that money because they don't really keep it, and they make interest on it.
Yeah.
And that's a wonderful racket they have, but that means they don't really have your money. They just pretend they have your money, and they... can borrow it from the Fed if they need to actually give you your money.
Mm-hmm. This is a great model that I had never heard of before, because most systems do this, a transaction fee, just taking a piece of everything. And it's great. I first heard of it with Loom. I see TrueLedger's doing it, and I guess VoucherSafe is also doing the same thing. And
Loom doesn't currently have any transaction fees. It just has usage tokens, which you have to pay for storage. And you're basically buying storage on the server with those usage tokens. But unless you buy a new space, it doesn't cost you anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I have usage tokens too, and that's this tran fee. The tran fee is going to come back to you when the other guy accepts your spend. You're going to get those two usage tokens back. If he denies your spend, then he gets to keep your usage tokens. And as I said, I did that to prevent spam. So that spam actually, if someone sends you a zero spend with a message you don't want, you deny the message and keep his usage tokens, and that means you're not going to get spam, because it costs money for somebody to send spam. The reason we have spam in the real world and they can handle a, you know, 0.1% acceptance rate or even lower is it costs them absolutely nothing to send as much mail as they want.
Right. There's also a flip side to that, and that's being able for people to be able to send out mail to people if they're willing to accept payment for actually reading the spam. And I don't think there's any systems actively doing this right now, but what's happening with all this digital cash stuff is that you can have a system that has no spam except the spam that you're getting paid for. And, you know, there is a business model for that. So something like this can actually allow for that, you know. Well, let's continue here with the inbox. I have an action here. It says action accept, reject, and ignore. And then a reply message that I can get. So when I process this, it throws a message back to you, I guess.
Yes.
And then in another field called a to account. And right now in the pull down, I just have main. Now, what does that mean? Because I thought that I'm logged in with the single account.
Well, as I said, you can have multiple sub accounts of your account. And those are separate places that will appear. So if you type something there, there's also a fill-in that you can use to say where to put it. That will create a new sub-account. And then from then on, you'll see that in the drop-down.
I don't see that on mine.
Oh, well, maybe I created it a different way. There should be some way to type that.
Is it because the account, because I'm in amount, this is the initial transaction for this asset type? Does that make this inbox?
No, that won't make any difference. It does tell you that it's a new asset type. And the reason it does that is because asset types are identified by hashes again. And it's actually the hash of the name of the asset, the issuer of the asset, and scaling information.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is stored as integers in the system, but you have to say where the decimal point goes and how many numbers to normally show after the decimal point. So like US dollars are actually stored as pennies, but with two decimal points, and you always show two decimal points.
okay.
And gold in Loom is usually seven decimal points, but you only show three of them unless there's something non-zero beyond that.
You said the U.S. dollars are stored as pennies. I thought that was you were making a joke there to the.
Oh no! I mean that's the precision we have for U.S.
dollars.
I'm just
kidding. With what's happening with the dollar, it's kind of funny to say yes, my U.S. dollars are stored as pennies. So
yeah,
anyway,
well, U.S. dollars hardly worth a penny when I was a kid. So
yeah. Well, let's fly through a couple of these. I'm going to process this inbox. And back to the spend form here. It shows the recipient here, and then next to the with the pull down, and next to it, it says mint coupon. So that instead of sending a message to that user in their inbox, it's actually going to spit out
Right. It'll bring up a coupon form, and it'll store the coupon in your outbox, and that's how I created the coupon that I gave to you. I created a usage tokens coupon, which is necessary in order to make a new account. But you could create a coupon in Bill Goldgram's now if you wanted to, and then mail it to somebody and say, okay, take this coupon and you can deposit it in your True Ledger account. You can choose mint coupon instead of choosing a recipient.
Okay.
Now, one of the drawbacks here is that if you have hundreds of contacts, that doesn't work very well with a dropdown. And so I have to figure out a UI to make that easier to deal with.
Well, I mean, you can deal with that when it starts to become a problem for people.
No one has complained about that yet, so I haven't fixed it.
I just created a little coupon for some Bill Goldgrams, and I am throwing it in the IRC chat channel for anyone who wants to pick it up off the floor and stick it in their pocket. Okay, we got this. Let's whip through the rest of the GUI here. We have,
of course,
contacts.
None of them can do anything with that because they don't have accounts. They have to get someone to give them some usage tokens so they can create a new account in order to use your Bill Goldgrams coupon.
Good point. On the contact screen, of course, ID, you put that in from the person who emailed you their ID if you didn't receive something from them. So it's just a regular contact address book type thing. Okay, servers.
Right.
This is interesting. What is this? You have a screen here where you can add servers and delete them. What is this about?
Yeah, the client can allow you to have accounts on multiple different TrueLedger servers.
Wow.
So the client actually stores multiple different client accounts that each has its own passphrase. And it allows each of them to connect to multiple different servers. So, for instance, I have a local server that runs on my PC, and I have the global TrueLedger server that I see in my server page. Now, usually in order to introduce a new server, unless you already have an account there, you have to stick a coupon in that place. And so to get a second account on another server, you'd paste the coupon there and then say add server, and it would use your same public key in order to make an account on that other server.
Wow.
And then you'd see two servers in the list down there. And
that's
I've had some thoughts about interbank protocols, so that if one issuer had issued the same asset on two different servers, that there'd be a way to do transfers between the different servers.
Uh-huh.
But I haven't implemented that yet, but it's certainly something that makes sense.
Yeah.
Since the asset ID is a hash of the information about the asset, you'll have the same ID on every server, and it's just that the asset itself also has the server ID as part of it. So those assets really are only good on that server until we get an inner server protocol. See, even I have a hard time not saying the word bank.
Are these checking accounts or savings or I'm just kidding, but I see some possibilities here with some distributed systems, like you said, with inter server transfer of assets. Interesting.
The only problem with TrueLedger is the client has to be pretty smart. He's got to be able to do all this PGP parse the message formats that go back and forth. And I can certainly see this as working in iPhone or a Google phone. They have enough processing power to be able to do it. There hasn't been a demand for that and someone to pay for doing development, so those don't exist yet.
I'll give one example of something that could be done with that. Is let's say that someone provided a TrueLedger wallet application for that ran with the iPhone, and you may not want to be doing transactions with your main TrueLedger accounts, but you may want to throw throw over $50 of some asset or 10 grams of something or 2 grams over into this wallet that is available from your iPhone that is running on a different server completely disconnected from where your main TrueLedger accounts may be. So this multiple server thing could work out for you to firewall your main balance from the stuff that you're walking around in your pocket, you know, considering iPhone security issues or other things. So, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense with Loom, too.
Yeah.
To have a separate account that you put stuff in that so that anyone who managed to swipe your passphrase for one account for your iPhone account would only get so much.
Yeah, it's the same. It all this stuff really mirrors so much of the real world, and that is, you know, you don't go walking around with your savings in your back pocket. You always leave the house with no more money than you're willing to lose unless you're doing a special transaction. And in those cases, you make sure you get there and get back. You go in the right time of day. You stay out of the places where you're at higher risk and stuff like that. So, okay, let's fly through this to assets. Okay, assets, I see add asset here. Now, is this the same screen when you know, it's really funny. This is so much like, it's very, very close to a lot of stuff with Loom.
Most of it was designed with Loom as the model, and I just happened to sign everything.
Okay, yeah, great.
So, now, and I also, unlike Loom, I store the scale and precision as part of the asset. They're not separable. And Patrick has made it so that he has this long description of an asset that includes the scale and precision, but you can still change them. Here in True Ledger, you can't change them. Once you set them, that's what that asset is.
Okay.
It's the name, the scale, the precision, and the issuer. Those four things.
Yeah.
And so yeah, you now can create your own asset. It costs you a few usage tokens, and there's a storage fee percent there, and so you can assign a storage fee, and then people will pay storage fees. I don't remember if I've done. Every transaction takes the storage fees now, but you also want to be able to collect storage fees on assets that are just sitting in an account for a long time. And so I don't remember if I did it. I either did it or will soon something that allows the server operator to run, or the asset issuer to run a process that goes and assesses storage fees to all the accounts that have been quiescent for a while.
Right.
And
so
those will appear in those people's inboxes, and they have no choice but to accept those transactions.
Okay, yeah, that's interesting. No, it's great because, you know, what you have transaction fees or storage fees or usage tokens, it opens up many types of business models and incentives for the people operating the servers or the issuing their assets, you know, that type of thing. Real quick, on the issue and the assets, when you add an asset here, just like in Loom, you can add any type of an asset. But to actually issue an asset in Loom, you add the asset, and then you go and you make a spend, and you're the first person that spends that, and at that point, you get a negative balance. Does that work the same way in here?
Same thing in True Ledger.
Okay.
It's stored exactly the same way. Minus one is how you store a zero balance if you're the issuer, but that's never shown in the user interface. I'm pretty sure you can see it if you look at the raw balance. So if you were to issue create an asset and then go look over in your raw balance, you'd see a minus one for that for your asset type as your balance.
Okay. Great. Well, we're coming up here on hitting the close of the hour pretty soon, so let's just fly through a few more of these.
We're past it on my clock, so.
Oh, well, yeah, from the time we started. We've been getting started later than the hour. But we'll close up here. On the fees screen, this is showing the way that all the assets, what their fees are. It's a fee schedule, basically. Correct?
Right. Yeah. Well, as a client, that's all you're going to see. If you happen to be the server operator, you're going to be able to change these things.
Okay.
And add non-refundable transaction fees.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Then under permissions, this looks like something that is just showing you a reflection of what a basic account has. This is not really for users, correct?
Right. This, again, the server operator is the only one that can change this. But this allows you to make a server that has fewer capabilities. You can prevent people from adding assets. You can prevent people from minting coupons.
Okay.
And actually, the minting is split up. Minting coupons means any coupon. Minting tokens means a token coupon. And so the server operator has the ability to create... like if you wanted to have a server that only contained Bill Goldgrams, you could create that and not allow anyone to create other assets.
Yeah, this is so what VoucherSafe, they said they're not allowing anybody to create assets in their system unless they go through this vetting process that is very strict, because they only want what they consider to be first-class issuers, and that's great, you know, for their model. And you could do that with this also. Did we talk about the difference between mint coupons and mint tokens?
Well, the only difference here is that normally you can mint a coupon in any asset type, and the permission system allows you to restrict it so people are only allowed to mint coupons in the usage token asset type. Actually, if you don't have mint tokens permission, you can't issue coupons in usage tokens. That means that allows you to set up a server where people aren't allowed to introduce other people to the server. They have to be introduced through some central registration mechanism.
Okay.
Right now, if you in this server, which is the default, if you have enough tokens to give to somebody, and it costs 10 or 12 tokens to create a new account, you can just give them a coupon in those tokens, and they have a new account. And I, as the server operator, didn't do anything or allow anything, and don't even know it happened unless I look carefully at my database.
Right. Okay. Got it. And then let's go fly over to this last menu section called admin. And in here I see the server that I'm connected to, the account name, the ID.
Oh, right, yeah. Well, the admin menu only appears if you're the server operator, and you now have a local server on your machine that hasn't been initialized yet. It doesn't have a server private key or any of that stuff, and there's a section in the documentation that shows you how to do that, and that would allow you to create a server that's running on your computer and that you could then aim your browser at on your computer.
Oh, okay. Hey, I have a question about this. I'm running the client on my machine, and I'm accessing it through the local host port 8782, and it asked me for a passphrase. So this client, even though it's running on my machine, is a completely multi-user client, correct?
Yes, you could have other people with accounts on your machine, or other people, anyone who could access your machine via the internet could go to that client and use it with their own passphrase and their own account.
Okay, so...
And talk to totally different TrueLedger servers than you're talking to.
Right. Oh, that's that takes it a little step further. So just to give an example, for an analogy here, would be there's a service on the internet called My Bitcoin, which has basically it's a wallet, a web-based wallet system for you, so you don't need to run your own Bitcoin client on your computer. You're allowing this My Bitcoin website to have sub accounts in their balance for you. So if somebody out there wanted to put up a test system, and let's assume that they weren't even going to run their own server, they were just going to offer a client, they could put up mytrueledger.com, and they would only need to run this client software that I downloaded and ran, and expose the web interface over the internet. They could wrap it inside of TLS, or of course they would want to, and offer a My True Ledger front end to your back end server.
Yes, of course most people would probably rather use the True Ledger server's client. I mean, there is one running on TrueLedger.com.
Right.
But if someone wanted to do that and add features, they could build their own client. I have it in the works, or I'm planning to write a sort of web app front end for the TrueLedger client, so that other front ends have a fairly easy way of using all the crypto that's inside of the client.
Yeah, right.
Fellow Traveler, is that his name? That's not quite right.
Yeah, Fellow Traveler from Open Transactions. Yeah,
that's something that Fellow Traveler wants so that he can connect the user interface he's building to TrueLedger.
Right, and he would be communicating with the API of a locally running TrueLedger client, not with the API of the server.
Right.
Yes, okay.
And so that secondary client wouldn't have to know how to do any of the crypto and wouldn't have to have a database.
Right.
And it would just be trolling the client in an easier way than screen scraping.
Uh-huh. We have a lot of Bitcoin listeners too, and the interface would be the same there as with the Bitcoin client. It has a JSON API that's real basic, and that is to the local client, and that takes care of everything with the servers and connecting to the other machines. But just to back up a little bit, I wanted to confirm that if I ran this, I could open this up. Let's just say that I'm assuming that this is all secure and everything. I could open up, run this TrueLedger client on my machine, expose it to the net wrapped in encryption, and actually be running a full-fledged mytrueledger.com website right now.
Yes.
That's it. Yeah, and you know, when you do that, then when people log into this and they use it, they're sitting here thinking to themselves, well, this is, I mean, it's really very close to the Loom system and the interface and the nomenclature of the entire system. So that's pretty fascinating to know that this client is actually a fully multi-user client, even to the degree of you exposing it on the net. You know, I know that when they do that, and they enter in their passphrases to, you know, mytrueledger.com, that the server, I mean, the operator of mytrueledger.com would be able to see the activity that's going on. But that's the same thing as with my Bitcoin and any other type of wallet-based system.
Same thing with Loom. The Loom server operator can see all your locations, and if he happens to be not trustworthy, he can take your money. And so...
Yeah,
so that's why
fine.
You'd prefer to run the client on your own machine, but sometimes you can't do that. So
And
the client also handles logging in from multiple different clients and keeping everything in sync with the server.
That's interesting. Okay. Oh yeah, I did see that on this main page up here on the left. I saw something resync. That's what that is. Resync with the server.
Well, that's if you want to do it explicitly. It's going to do it automatically if you try to do a transaction and it finds there's a disagreement. And as I said, I haven't made that work correctly yet. It always trusts the server.
Oh, that's something
else. The correct way is to say, okay, I have a newer timestamp, so I'm the one I need to trust, not you, server. You, server, you correct your balance, not me correct mine.
Okay. So, have you looked at all into the binary running on... on an Android or the iPhone?
No. Clojure is working. I use Clojure's Common Lisp, and I work for Clojure on making CCL run on Android. It will already run on the iPhone, but I doubt that Apple will ever let us sell an app through their App Store. So. You'll either have to build it yourself or have a jailbroken iPhone in order to run it there. But it looks promising that we'll be able to get it to run on Android and that they'll let us actually ship it for Android because that's a much more open platform. Mm-hmm. We already have the system running on the ARM chip. It's just that we haven't done all of the system integration to make the UI usable from Lisp. And, of course, you don't really need a UI for TrueLedger. It's just an app that has to be running in the background and provide you a web server.
Go ahead.
Definite possibilities of that for Android and possibly for unlocked iPhones, but neither of those are quite ready yet. Have the Lisp itself working.
Yeah, it's just interesting to see that the possibility might be there that you can – you know, just to generate some more binaries that are, you know, multi.
It's, Yeah, it's not very big. It uses about 70 megs of, the server uses about 70 megs of RAM over on BillSt.Clair.com, which is where TrueLedger.com is running. The client probably uses a little bit less than that.
Well, the binary is only, what, eight megs or something like that?
Well, it's 8 megs compressed. It expands into about 25 megs.
Okay.
Which is pretty small nowadays.
Well, no, it's great because, you know, running the interface as a web server, you're not going to have to worry about all the details of the graphical interface using the browser as the GUI. And worst case, you might want to just consider a few different styles, CSS style sheets for the different screen layouts or something like that, you know. So
that's true. That could make it work a lot better on small screens.
Yeah.
It actually, as I remember, it actually does draw the balance screen differently on an iPhone. It recognizes the size of an iPhone, and it makes it the whole thing narrower. And instead of having two columns with balances at the top and the spend stuff at the right, it puts those one on top of the other.
Yeah.
And so that makes it fit better on an iPhone screen.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bill, this has been a real nice little run-through of this. I've enjoyed this. I mean, I've studied some of this and went through the your documentation and everything, but there were even some things we went over today that made more sense than what I had seen before. And thank you very much for coming on. You have the last word. Anything you wanted to say before we take off here?
Well, you're very welcome. I'm surprised we filled an hour so easily. So we may have to do it again.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, keep us up to date on what's going on the, at least on your blog and the chat channel. Do you want to give out contact information for your fantastic blog?
We'll just go to BillSt.Clair.com/blog. That's BillSt.Clair. And if you just type in BillSt.Clair.com, you'll see a link to the blog. I'm actually rewriting my blog software in Lisp right now and expect that to be up in a couple of weeks. And it'll be much faster and much easier for me to do and a lot more fun for me to do, so maybe I'll do it more.
Oh, great. Yeah, well, we appreciate your – I don't know about everyone. I appreciate your blog over the years. A lot of great stuff in there in the archives and on a regular basis. So thanks for all your...
I'm preserving all the archives and I'm preserving all of the URLs, so all the Google stuff will still be valid.
Oh, good. Great. Well, Bill, thanks again, and we'll see you in chat. Everybody, you can find Bill inside the agora.anarplex.net IRC server. We see him in the Agora channel, and... check out his blog and check out the True Ledger. Thanks again, Bill. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Hiro. Bye.
Bye. All right, another great show on Cypherpunked. Another project dealing in all these circles of digital cash and Cypherpunked money systems. Thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll be back again tomorrow with another special guest. Now.
Dodge this.
This is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. AgoristRadio.com is sponsored by MetroPipe.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
Broadcasting from deep within the Second Realm, you are listening to AgoristRadio.com.